Hello everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. Have you ever fantasized about traveling around the world, checking out meetings wherever you went, scheduling your travels around NA conventions, and really enjoying the welcome of the fellowship, city after city? Whenever there was an invitation, maybe you'd get to stay in members' houses, and other times, you'd learn the ropes of the cheap hostels and the transit systems of the various cities. Yeah, I've had this fantasy too. But who could ever pull something like that off? Well, our guest today is Greg Kay, a friend of mine who is into month 7 of at least a year on the road doing exactly that. I'm Ron, and my co-host Dave and I thought it would be fun to catch up with him and hear some of his stories from that adventure. We had also been planning to do a couple shows featuring addicts who got clean very young and stayed to put together a long stretch of recovery. Greg fits into this category as well. He got clean in 1983 at the age of 17. Upon turning 50 this year, he set out on his trip. We'll let him tell you about all of that in a minute. I've been watching his progress on Facebook as he has popped up in various places, always making new friends, having new adventures, and generally being Greg, which you'll see in the next hour and a half is quite a journey in its own right. We spoke in the early evening our time, but he was in England at 1 a.m. in a house where he was staying with friends he had made along the way. The spirit of this conversation really showcases one of the greatest aspects of this lifestyle. We're part of one big worldwide family just waiting to greet and welcome us almost anywhere in the world we choose to go. And we're often raised by each other in many ways as well. This is a conversation that highlights both of those aspects of our NA family. Dave started us off in the usual way, and as recovery conversations tend to do, this one just kept getting better as we went along.
Yeah, Greg, how are you?
I'm good. I'm really good.
We traditionally start these out by asking our interviewees, how did you find the NA message, when and where, and what were your early days like?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So my clean date is June 29th, 1983. And I found out, so this is how I found out about NA. I was in a rehab, an adolescent rehab in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, 1983. Didn't want to be there. Didn't want to be clean. My typical MO when I was institutionalized prior to this would be first opportunity, break out, run away, go get loaded. But it was such a scary looking neighborhood around this hospital I was in, and I couldn't figure out how it'd survive in pajamas running through this neighborhood. And it was the only reason I was staying in this treatment center. Someone who had gone to that treatment center, apparently before I had been there, it was a 30-day program, was driving across country to go to college and stopped by to visit this treatment center. And I was curious, really, why anybody would want to come back to this place. I hated that place. I wanted to know, like, why he would go out of his way to come back here. And he was talking to somebody else that I guess he had known when he was in there that had been there a little longer than me. And they're talking, and I'm kind of slightly paying attention to the conversation. And he mentions, and the first time I had ever heard it, he mentioned Narcotics Anonymous. And it was like that moment, I think, like, that makes so much more sense, narcotics. So, and I'm like, what is this Narcotics Anonymous you talk about? And he's like, oh, you don't want to go there. And like, well, why not? And he's like, because they still drink in NA. And the meetings are held by candlelight, or he said lantern light, which was weird because I never heard anybody use the word lantern light before. And they play jazz music. And that was my first introduction to NA. And that's why I think it's important to realize to do PI, because if we're not doing PI, that guy is doing PI.
You know? That's right.
And So when I got back to Albuquerque, after, not after that treatment center, because from that treatment center, they highly recommended that I go to a much longer term treatment center in Minnesota, which wasn't Hazleton. We didn't have that kind of money. And then from there, that treatment center recommended that I go to a long-term halfway house, which was a 2-year commitment. And in that second halfway house, I turned 18 and I said, I'm done. And they told me if I leave, I will use. And I told them if I stay, I'm going to use. So I'm going to take my chances, not in this terrible place. And I flew back to Albuquerque and I went to an AA meeting, because I learned in treatment that if I go back and hang out with my old buddies and friends, I was going to use. And only program they introduced me to in the treatment centers was back then was AA. And I showed up at a meeting and this old lady told me that if I wanted to stop drinking, that was their problem, I think they say. And if I wanted to drink, I could take this newcomer ship they gave me and go to a bar. And I remember thinking even then at 18 years old that I wasn't old enough to get into a bar, but I was all right. I was all right. If that's what I had to do to stay clean, I was going to do that forever. If I had to, I wasn't going to go back to using. I had no questions. I had no doubt in my mind that the next stop was going to be, you know, that these institutions were going to be how my life was going to continue going. And I knew it was going to progress to jail and prison someday and most likely death. And one of the guys that was in my aftercare, I had known from high school. And I asked him if he would take me to a meeting because I didn't have a car. And the next day he picked me up for the meeting. And I noticed that we weren't heading the direction to the one meeting I had already gone to. And I said, well, where are we going? And he goes, oh, we're going to this NA meeting at this hospital. And I actually got scared because I didn't think I was strong enough to be around people that were drinking.
And listening to that jazz music.
And lantern lights. So I was kind of freaked out about the whole thing. But also, you know, I'm 18 years old. I'm around someone I knew from high school. I had to act cool. You know, I couldn't act like, hey, dude, just not sure I'm ready for this yet. So we went to the meeting and, of course, I was surprised that there was no jazz music or lantern light, and best I can tell, nobody was drinking in the meeting. I don't remember anything that was said at that NA meeting, but after the meeting, he goes, hey, we got to stick around because I'm going to this business meeting. And he was my ride and my cigarette hookup for the night. So I was going to hang out till he was done. So I was in this business meeting, which was an H&I meeting. And of course I had no idea what a business meeting was. I had no idea what H&I was, hospitals and institutions. And they were discussing bringing the first meeting into a prison in New Mexico. And what they were discussing was, this would have been January of 1984, they did not have the funds to buy literature to bring to the meeting. And they were just, and this guy who I never met, he was obviously the leader of NA, was this guy, George, who was saying that when he lived in California and was doing H&I there, this is how they did it. And they brought literature in. And he goes, and he said, this is how we're going to raise money for literature. We're going to have an auction. And this auction is going to consist of people in NA auctioning stuff off to other people in NA. And I'm barely listening to all this. And then all of a sudden he turns and he points at me. And he goes, and you're going to be our auctioneer. And I'm like thinking, how did he know I always wanted to be an auctioneer? So and it's like, so I was acting cool. Like, okay. But inside I was like, this is so cool. So I went back to every NA meeting there was in town, and there wasn't even 7 a week at that point, to make sure he did not forget that I was, because I was scared if I didn't show up, he would think I relapsed and he'd get someone else to be the auctioneer. So I went to every meeting, and I couldn't go up to the guy and say, hey, by the way, George, I really want to be the auctioneer. I'll make sure I'm there. I just went like everywhere. Hey, what's up? You know? So, and then the cool thing is it was apparently the largest fundraiser the area had ever had. And I was the auctioneer. And we raised, obviously, we got enough money to get some literature. And I sat on that panel for the first first H&I meeting in Mexico at the Las Lunas Penitentiary. And none of us had ever, except for this guy George, had ever sat on a panel at a prison. Or even there was no H&I meetings in town. There wasn't even any, there were no treatment centers. So we didn't know. So we're all looking at ourselves like, I don't know if this is a good idea. And we're like kind of looking at it like, how should we start? Do we read? What do we do? And all of a sudden one of the inmates stood up and he says, hey, AA brings us donuts. What do you guys bring? And everybody's on the panel like looking at it like, what do we say? And I stood up and I like, NA is not about donuts, man. NA is using is about consequences. NA is about recovery. And everybody's on the panel. I was like, shut up. So but it went good. None of us got hurt. And,
I was trying to track with that early stuff. You said you were 17 when you first landed in that treatment center. And did you stay clean since then? So you've been clean since you were 17.
Yeah, never. Yeah, one newcomer chip kind of guy. And that's the main thing is when I was in that treatment center, it was the first one after detox and all that. And I was going to get high the minute I could. I mean, it was just like no questions about it. Matter of fact, when I was in detox, they came in marching in one morning and confronted me in front of everybody because they found drugs in my wallet I had checked into the detox with. And I remember just saying, well, don't touch it. It's mine. Like, I want that back whenever I figure out how to get out of it. That is mine. They made a big deal. Like, well, I'm in a drug rehab center. What do you expect? And I remember I had like the first like real emotion that I've had for like a long time. And it was just sadness. And I hadn't heard that our jails, institutions, and death staying yet, but I felt it. A couple of years earlier, I had been in a mental hospital, and I kind of thought that was a fluke, that they made a mistake, they made a mistake by putting me there. I didn't deserve to be there. I was resentful for being put there. And then I was now in something else. I wasn't even sure what it was, but I just kind of felt like this is what my life is going to continue to look like, because I knew there was no way I was going to stay clean. And it wasn't because I didn't want to stay clean, which I didn't at that time. But didn't matter if I wanted to stay clean or not, is I did not, I knew that I could not successfully do anything. I had, when I was 6 or 7 years old, I decided I wanted to be a Cub Scout. My mom went out and brought me the whole uniform, and then I went and hung out, and I got all freaked out because I was hanging out with a bunch of kids my age, and I never went back. You know, I decided a year later that I wanted to take up karate, and they took me to the first class, which is free. The next day on the playground, I picked a fight with a kid. And when he punched me in the face, I realized I hadn't learned anything in karate. And I never went back to karate. Same thing with driver's ed, high school, everything. Everything I ever got into, I quit or failed at. So I didn't, this staying clean thing was not going to happen. And I think that, and it's the attitude I took into my first meeting. I think every time I pick up a new clean time medallion, another year goes by, I never felt like I have this thing. You know, obviously I don't have the obsession to use anymore. I have no desire to use. There's nothing attractive about that. I can't imagine anything that anybody would ever say to me would make the idea of using it again at all interesting or attractive. But I don't think I have, I don't think I'm immune to relapse. I still think with 33 years clean, I could more slowly than I would when I was new, start engaging in behaviors that I would feel low enough about myself that I did not feel I deserved to stay clean.
Let me ask you about the Albuquerque NA community at that time. You're 18 years old.
Yeah.
I gather the basic text was out.
Yes.
How big was the community, and were you finding other young people to hang out with?
As I remember it, I remember when I first got in, there was like 3 NA meetings a week. And shortly after that, it had grown to maybe another meeting, And before we know it, we actually did have a meeting. We could go every evening. You know, I had nothing to compare it to. It was good to be around people that welcomed me. And I kind of maybe even knew that they kind of had to. And I was very obnoxious back. Some people would say I'm still obnoxious, but I was really obnoxious back. I was one of those kind of guys, one of those newcomers that would share twice at every meeting. And people would actually come up to me afterwards and say, the guy who eventually became my sponsor, who got me that first service position, would come up to me after the meeting once, and he goes, you know, when you share that first time, it's the greatest you ever heard. You got to talk about feelings and really good program. And that second share, it's all crazy. So I got a suggestion. Just do the first one. It's really cool. You do the first one.
Yeah. That's pretty much a universal cardinal sin in NA. Don't try to share twice.
Yeah, exactly. But he knew how to talk to me. Like, yeah, I want to sound cool. And then there were, I think the first wave of us, which was probably five or six of us, you know, we did H&I together, we did service together. And I also think that's a big deal, because I think a lot of times the young people crowds can get, can get a little unhealthy sometimes. There's not as taking their recovery. I feel sometimes not taking the recovery as serious. And there was a second wave that came in when I think I had about 2 years clean. And it's when all the treatment centers started popping up. And it got really big, and we started obviously having young people meetings and stuff like that. And we would go out like after coffee for meetings. We would go out for coffee after meetings and stay all night. There were 24-hour coffee shops, and we'd be, you know, young people just with no jobs, nothing to do. We'd stay at these 24-hour coffee shops and not buy a thing. You know, lucky they got a cup of coffee out of us, and it's just insane. And it was great because you had people, you know. We were doing what young people do, but we were doing it clean.
You know, what I find interesting is you're kind of describing my early recovery too, which was in a similar time, early 80s, got clean in 79. So that same era. And there were a lot of young people. When I got clean at 23, I was kind of older for the NA crowd at that time. And, it seemed like the word in the treatment world at that time was that NA is a good option for young people in some places. That would be regional. You know, sounds like maybe Albuquerque was one of those places, because if people 15, 16, 17, 18 don't just wander into recovery, they get put there by somebody. And so it must have been a trend at that time in the rehab world, get young people in, get them to NA.
Yeah. And I think a few of the members would, sometimes they started working in the treatment field and those treatment centers. So they were, you know, either driving the van, working as counselors. And then there were even some halfway houses that, you know, they were like the live-in staff. You didn't need any real qualifications, but you kind of lived there and you drove everybody to the treatment center. So that was a big part of it as well.
I haven't heard you say anything. Well, I guess a little bit, but I haven't heard you say much about AA. Was AA a part of it? Were people going to NA and AA back then?
Yeah. So when I came in, I was, I learned in treatment that I was chemically dependent. So I would introduce myself as chemically dependent for my first few months. And then I switched to addict alcoholic. And my crew, which was about three or four of us at that time, every day at noon, we're all hopelessly unemployed. We went to the AA noon meeting because we didn't have any NA noon meetings. And they would never call on me. I had such a resentment against that meeting. And I had such great things to share too on the topics. They never call on me. But then I'd get handfuls of their cookies. We didn't have cookies in NA, but they had cookies at AA. And when they wouldn't call on me, I'd go back and get like a stack of their Oreo cookies and sit there and just and we could obviously smoke in the meetings too. And then every evening meeting, just hang out all day in between them. And I think once I finally got a job, I cut out the noon meetings and stopped going to AA.
You know, when you're sharing about how people used to introduce themselves, how you used to introduce yourself, you know, we were chemically dependent or drug addicted alcoholics or, you know, any number of ways that, And then that whole language thing kind of came in. Do you remember that? Do you remember when that hit, like in Albuquerque? Did you start to feel like people were trying to get you to standardize your language in any way?
Oh yeah, it started really fast. I think we had the first. I think it, if I'm not if America before we had any conventions, we hosted the. Western, I think it was the Western States Unity Convention. And we'd have these speakers come in that talked about it was really this purity message, you know? And it was like, we're not, we're not addict alcoholics. We're not dope fiends. We're just addicts. And it wasn't a very loving message, but it was kind of like this, yeah, you know? And so I jumped on it because, and it was just kind of like my team's the best team kind of, you know, it was almost more of a rivalry. And, and in some ways it was healthy. I remember some people would really got very offended by that, but it also like, it really like in a way made me like, I remember for myself, I felt I had this NA pride thing going on, but in retrospect, it's not the nicest way to greet newcomers.
Yeah. Especially if they're being corrected when they're trying to pour their heart out and they're being corrected at their early meeting. But I think you hit on it. There is something healthy about there's something tribal and exclusionary and kind of prideful and all of that about it. But there's also something like, if you think back to all of the way it was something they were trying to correct. Like the guy who started the meetings where I got clean in Fargo, he always introduced himself as a needle pushing, pill popping drunk. That was his moniker, you know, and people were trying to be one more colorful than the other with the way that they did that sort of stuff. I'm a junkie and a juicer, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. And so
I'm a recovered addict.
Yeah, that too.
You got Jimmy K on audio calling himself a recovered addict.
Yeah, well, that also traces back to AA, because in AA that is the language. We are recovered alcoholics, and if the problem is alcohol, they truly are recovered. Yeah. They're not drinking, you know. Yeah. But if you're, I think when you shift that and say the problem is my addiction. Yeah, it's a little bit of a taller order to say I'm recovered from that. You know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's jump ahead a little bit. There may be stuff to fill in the middle. I'm not sure, but I'd like to get current a little bit with you because you're out there in the world right now. One of the reasons we wanted to talk to you is that it's just such you have quite a life. You decided you were going to. Well, I'll let you tell the story. You decided you were going to do some travel. What went into that decision, and what did you decide to do?
Okay. So I turned 50 in January, but I'll back up. When I turned 40 10 years ago, like, oh, great. The king's going to tell a long story. When I turned 40, I was coming off some financial wounding I did to myself. And I wanted to do something kind of big for my 40th birthday. And I thought, you know, I could probably afford to do a little travel. So I was at a, and I was inspiration. I was at a meeting. This kid talked about this amazing trip he had to Southeast Asia and hooking up with the NA fellowship there and I remember it was inspiring. And it wasn't even what he was saying he did. It's just those kind of just the way he said it. I just was getting this vibe from this guy. So I remember going up to the meeting after him. I had never even met him before. I was living in LA at the time, and he just went on, and I was like, how much did this cost? And blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I think I can do this for a couple of weeks. So I went out to Thailand, and I planned it that it was going to be near the Asian Pacific Zonal Forum or whatever they call it. So I can maybe meet some people in NA to hang out with. And anyhow, I had such an amazing time doing that I had decided the next year I was going to go back for a month. I could afford to do it. And on that trip, I was doing a jungle trek, and I had met a guy from Spain that was on his honeymoon, but they were traveling for a year. And it's just like, I was just amazed by that. Just traveling for a year. And I was just like, and it was this long walk through the jungle. And I was just like, how, you know, what do you do with your car? What did you do with your house? What about your job? And they basically put everything on hold. They got rid of their car, their house. They saved us money. I asked them how much money. And I decided right there and then that when I turned 50, which would have been 9 years, that's what I wanted to do. And it was just this little idea that turned into this dream. And I started, and I envisioned how I would do it. And I decided that, you know, at first I was going to save money, and then I thought, you know, I work for myself. Maybe instead of shutting my business down for a year, what if I can change the way I do business where I can actually have employees? Because prior to that, I was just a one-man operation. And that was a big a big thing to do in my business. You know, I didn't know if I can handle expenses, the responsibilities, but I decided to give it a shot. Over the last 9 years, I've been doing extending how long I travel, and been part of it is I just love traveling, but also it was to test how my business would, how I can run my business through just my phone and my computer. So on January, when I turned 50, I bought a one-way ticket. And I went to first Dubai, which was kind of not because I wanted to go to Dubai, but I was using frequent flyer points, and there was a good flight to Dubai. And, met up with NA in Dubai, and great people, and invited me to hang out. And it was just like wherever you go, anywhere, just so nice. And then from there, I went to Oman, which I know there's NA there. I had a contact number there, but I was only there for a couple of nights. But then I went to India, and I love social media in NA. About I don't know how many years ago, this guy from India friended me on Facebook, and I only I knew he's NA because when I looked at all the mutual friends, you were his mutual friend. Everybody we knew is his mutual friend. So I thought I was just friending everybody he knows in NA. And when I was in India, I know a guy from India. So I looked on Facebook, I remembered his name, and I found, I sent a message. He goes, oh yeah, here's a meeting. It's a good English speaking meeting, and you should come to our convention. And I had no plans of going to the convention, and they were so friendly. I mean, they're just, in Mumbai, I go to a meeting, and, they're like, we're going to go get tea afterwards. You want to come get tea? Of course I want to get tea with you guys. And I'm thinking, when in Mumbai, it seems like every corner is a tea shop. But for some reason, I'm getting on the back of someone's motorbike, and it's raining out, and zipping in and out of traffic. And I'm thinking, okay, my year trip around the world is going to end like 3 weeks in. but it's like some tea shop that they all go to, and people that even weren't at the meeting were showing up. And I was told that I should possibly... From the people I was staying at, Airbnb, they were like, yeah, at night, you probably don't want to take the metro back. You should take a taxi. And so it was finally time to go back. I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to take a taxi. I just need to walk to the corner and find one. And they're like, no, you need to take, the metro. It's cheaper. And I'm like, I don't know. And they literally, someone got on the metro with me to take me to my stop. They wouldn't let me pay for my tea. They wouldn't let me pay for my metro ticket. They wouldn't let me pay for my water at the, and they got me to a tut-tut, explained to the tut-tut driver where I was going, or the motorcycle taxi. And I wasn't going to go to the convention. I thought, yeah, I don't know where I'm going to be in a couple of weeks. I'm doing this all on one-way tickets. I'm not really planning much ahead. I decided to go to the convention, and it was, on this beach town where very few Westerners go. So it was like, people were just amazed to see a Westerner on their beach. They would come up and talk to me and want to take selfies with me. But the convention, guys had took trains for 3 days across India just to come to this convention. And unlike like when I think of a regional convention in the United States, if you get a hotel room and you dress up, here they had hotel rooms, which was part of the registration pack, but you were grouped up with four or five other people in the room, and all the meals were included, and they cooked them all in a tent in the parking lot. And it was just, the energy was just unreal. It was just, and the countdown was fireworks, singing. It's like a Bollywood production. It was like unreal.
Where was it? Was it Mumbai?
It was in a town called Puri, P-U-R-I. Sometimes I think if you're like, when I'm isolated in one area for forever and that's all you know, you kind of maybe, or I did kind of think, this could just be some weird fluke that's going on here, that, that our recovery, I don't know. But when you go to another part of the world and you sit in a meeting and they're sharing the same things, the same struggles, going through the same things. The newcomers are worried about ever being able to sleep, get a good night's sleep, and old timers are worried about ever having a good relationship or whatever, and it's the same thing. The same solutions are being shared, the same just welcome you when you get there. It's just amazing. It just blows my mind. So I went to lots of meetings in India.
I saw a picture of you. I think you had like a bindi on your forehead, and you were in some nice repose someplace with I don't know if there was a Buddha behind you or whatever. It just looked like you were having, you looked genuinely serene. It looked like you were having a good time.
That was a great day. So I was in Goa, which is a really fun place. And I signed up for a excursion where I was staying at a hostel and they're going to pick me up at like 6 a.m., which I was a little hesitant. And we're going to go to this waterfall, but it's like a couple hour drive. And then from there, they have to switch you to four wheel drive vehicles to get through the jungle to this waterfall. And we got to a restaurant and they said, you know, you can go in there and get some tea and breakfast if you want. And, there was a bunch of Westerners, and there's this one family. It was a father and two grown sons, Indian family. And I decided I was going to sit with them because I figured they knew what to order. So I sat with them. They were the greatest people. And then I was in like all their selfies that day. Like every picture they took, they wanted me in the picture. Like even some point I thought, well, they probably want pictures without me. They would like call me over, and they wouldn't be like, no matter what we did, they were like, come, Greg, we're going now. And even when we got to the waterfall, they're like, I wasn't going to take your life vest because I figured I could float in the waterfall. And they're like, the father, like, you have to have a life vest. Like, no, I think I'll be all right. He goes, no, you have to take a life vest. So they made me take a life vest with him. It was just a great day. And every day, like when they were ready to go somewhere, like, come on, we're going to do something else. And it was just amazing.
How many months into this trip are you now? This one-way ticket, 7 months. Where are you?
I'm in London. And so in June, which is now September, June was my 33 years. And I wanted to make sure I was around lots of English-speaking meetings. I was actually in Berlin prior to coming to London, which actually they have amazing English-speaking meetings. Berlin is such a great English-speaking fellowship. And that when I first meeting, I showed up in Berlin was not an English speaking meeting, but I just used the app, the, NA Meeting Finder app on my iPhone to find that meeting and, get to the meeting a little bit late and, you know, enough to introduce myself as a visitor. They immediately set someone up to translate for me. And then without even asking how much clean time I had, asked me to be there, the speaker for the night. And I thought, man, you guys are taking a big risk here, but, like I would never do that. So I got to London and of course amazing fellowship here. And I already know people because of world conventions and people who visit the United States, I've already know people here in the area. And, it's been great. So I've been in and out of London the last couple of months, but from India, I went to Thailand, went to the Thai convention, which is a great convention and saw people I know, which is a great way to also travel is to then reconnect with people I know. I was asked to speak at a treatment center in Thailand, and there's a guy at the treatment center that owns a hostel in Bristol and runs a soup kitchen for the refugees. And he's invited me down. So I'm thinking about doing that here in a couple of weeks and going to stay with him and checking that out. But, and then from Thailand, I went to Myanmar, which as far as I know, there's no NA meetings in Myanmar, but I had a wonderful 3 weeks there. From there, I went to Sri Lanka. And then I've been in Europe for the last 4 months. And I went to the European Convention in Paris, which was great. And I saw a lot of people I know. I also went to when I was in Rome early in the year, if they have English speaking meetings, I didn't find them, but someone would always sit with me and whisper in my ear what they were saying, which I'm very ADD and it's very hard to hear two people speak at me at once like that. It almost makes me want to jump out of the chair.
Yeah. Sometimes the guy two rows in front of you is getting pissed off and they finally look back and they see what's going on. They think you're just sitting back there chatting, you know, but then they realize there's a translation going on. They cool their jets a little.
Mm-hmm. And the Rome Fellowship was so friendly and we go out and they take me to these amazing restaurants afterwards. So they're like, yeah, come back to our Rome convention in a couple of months. Like, yeah, not going to happen, but sure. And then they're like, I'm the program chair. I'll have you speak. I'm like, okay, I'll come. I'll most likely come back for that. But then the guy kept pushing, like, book your registration now. So okay, I'm committed. So I went back, and they were so friendly. They picked me up, and they had planned a whole day for the out of towners at the beach, and they even gave me a place to stay prior to the convention. And even before that, because people I met at the Rome meetings saw that I was in Spain, and they're like, come to the Spanish convention. And I ended up at the Spanish convention because I knew people that were going to be there. And
sounds like so much fun.
I went to the Lisbon convention, no English speaker meetings there. But again, someone whispered in my ear what they were saying. And then a few of us that did speak English found a place at someone's hotel, had a rooftop deck, and we had an English speaker meeting there.
What I find when I'm away from the U.S. for a long time and around people who don't speak English, or even in London, I was in London, and the way that they speak English is so different that especially right in the inner city, I was staying with someone right in the inner city, that a certain kind of fatigue would set in that I wasn't really familiar with. Fatigue over constantly trying to communicate, fatigue over having a handful of coins in my hand and not knowing what they are, trying to buy something and just hold out my coins to the person and let them pick the right ones out of my hand, that kind of stuff. Do you ever find yourself just like fatigued with that? Or you seem to have a lot of, I don't know, you're so gregarious. Does that problem ever set in where you just go, I don't know if I can take any more of this?
You know, it's weird because I was a little concerned because when the World Convention was in Rio last year, I booked a month in Brazil and had a wonderful time. But it was like 3 weeks in. I was like, I had this moment that I was like ready to go home. I'm like, I hope this doesn't like kick in like at some point in my trip. But I think the fact that I was set to do this for a year, that I kind of like, it's just never happened. It's like, I'm not, no rush to be anywhere. So I've had like some ideas of what I would do to get what I thought if that situation came up like that, how to reground myself. And I thought that like, I would like find a place I can cook a meal and stuff like that. And really, I don't think I've cooked a meal this year. And maybe I have, I don't even remember. But I think now the London thing, cause I got people that I know here now that are like inviting me into their homes to stay, and it's very grounding, and I feel like I'm, you know, the weather is just unreally beautiful. Like even the people in London are like, yeah, we never get weather like this. So it's like, I'm really like not trying not to rush out of here. Like I'm just gonna enjoy this weather for a bit and not try to, but no, I just enjoy it. But I don't feel like I have to see everything. So there's been periods in the last 7 months where I've just done sightseeing. Like, no, I just want to sit around coffee shops or hang out with friends or people. Yeah. And there's other times like, no, I want to go see museums and take pictures of things, you know?
I totally relate to that. It's fun. You don't want to have been someplace and not seen the most interesting stuff there on some level. But for me, the most interesting stuff there are those NA people and those conversations around those tables in the coffee shops and that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, I'll some about that.
Yeah.
It's the best.
So how many conventions do you think you've been to since you've been on the road?
Yeah, way too many, I think. I really never even imagined I would go to this many conventions in 1 year. So I went to started in the Indian, the India convention. Then I went to the Thai convention. And then I went to the Spanish, it's convention in Spain. And then from there, I went to the Lisbon, the convention, the Portuguese convention. And then I was in the Rome convention. And I was in the European convention. That's cool. That was my first European convention in Paris. And then Sweden convention. So I've been to 7 conventions. And at the Indian convention, I met someone from Sweden. And they're like, my sponsor's the program chair. You should come to our convention. And So I went to Sweden and I get to the convention and like, and I knew I was speaking and I'm like, so when do I speak? And they look at me like, I'm like, you don't know when you speak. You're the Saturday night speaker. And like, I really didn't know. I was and like the main speaker. I thought it was like a panel speaker. Like the kind of way the email read to me and I is like, you'll be sitting at the main table. So I thought like, oh, I'll be like one of those like panels. Like everybody gets 20 minutes or something like that, which that's cool. No pressure. And, but I'm really glad that I didn't know that prior to coming to the convention. Cause I would have kind of like got all freaked out and I had never been a Saturday night main speaker before. I feel there's a lot of responsibility on that speaker. You set the whole tone for the entertainment. I always think Saturday night's the big finale. You know, it's a big, all the entertainments that night. It's, you know, I think the Saturday night speakers make or break convention myself. And I'm kind of judgmental. I thought some Saturday night speakers in the past have totally taken the vibe down on a Saturday night convention. And but I'm glad I didn't know. So
So how'd you do? Did you bring the vibe down?
No, I thought I did really good. The young people seemed to like me. So they like,
all right.
Did they have an interpreter for you or you just did it in English and they were fine?
Okay. I needed an interpreter. They don't need an interpreter. The people in Sweden speak great. They speak really good English. They, but all the other meetings, I was the only English speaking meeting, but there's always someone who can interpret. And they were great interpreters too. There's one guy sat next to me and not only would he interpret what they're saying, but he actually do it in the emotional tone they were doing it. It was like, dude, you need to do this for a living. It's like unbelievable how well, like even like when the person was getting excited, he was getting excited. It was really like,
that's great.
Yeah.
It's like watching the people at conventions who sign up on stage.
Yeah.
It makes you want to learn sign because they're so animated.
So animated. This guy,
beautiful to watch.
Yeah. It's beautiful to watch. Exactly.
So you've been you've been sort of Forrest Gumping it around some pretty interesting stuff like Brexit and terrorism events and you've been sort of close to some of that stuff, huh?
Yeah, well, so I got to London and I actually because our politics is so crazy, you know, but I had a friend that I actually met a friend that I met while I was in India who's not in the program invited me to stay with at her place here, and she her to-do list the next day was to go vote, and she voted to stay, and I felt like part of that thing because I went to the polling place where I had a picture out front. I even got a I voted sticker from there, even though I obviously didn't vote. And I was just kind of like felt like I was involved in her pride, you know, their national pride of actually staying and being progressive and stuff like that. And I was, you know, part of the feeling like I was part of the young hipness of London. And then the next day when the vote to leave came up, it was like this heavy depression around everybody that I was hanging out with. It just really was weird. And I'm like, oh, how sad. And then I look at the pound, the dollar, and it was the lowest it had been in 31 years. So I'm having this kind of like excitement because all of a sudden London's on sale for 20% off for me. So I have to kind of hide my enthusiasm about it. Like, oh, it's so sad what you guys did. Like, nobody can afford to eat out now. Thanks in London. And also it kind of scared me like, wow, things like that could happen in their political system. What can happen in ours? But I guess people don't want to hear that on a podcast.
Yeah, I'm tempted to engage in that conversation, but I won't.
Yes, and it's not a good one.
There's outside issues swirling all around that.
Outside issues, yeah. So I did. So outside issues, interesting. That is the same person who's not in 12-step, is not in NA, who I met at a hostel in India, who I connected with when I was in London. Was trying to get me to go to UK festivals. I guess this time of year is really big. They have music festivals and they're all like big festivals in fields somewhere with camping and things like that. And I'm like, not my scene. And then she's like, well, and she kept sending me links to ones I should go to. And she sent me this one to the spiritual retreat with like lots of yoga and meditation. And it was also drug and alcohol free festival, which, so I'm like, okay. And really what got me was she said, you know, you don't want to leave the UK and not have been to a UK festival. So she sold me on the idea. I went this last weekend and they had 12-step meetings. I went right to the question answers on their website and they said, someone had asked, will there be 12-step meetings? They said, yes. So I thought, well, you know, if it's not NA, maybe I can start an NA meeting there if they give me a space or something like that. So as I'm setting up my tent, that I borrowed tent, and there's all these, like, you can print out like a schedule, all kinds of things, cool things going on, band, you know, musicians, yoga retreats, meditation retreats. There was one I went to called Conscious Speed Dating, which I thought was pretty interesting. But these people are setting up a tent that right next to me, they're like, it starts, they're talking to each other like, oh, it starts. Someone said, what time does it start? And the guy says 8 o'clock, which is like pretty soon. I said, what starts at 8 o'clock? And they like hesitantly said, we're going to a 12-step meeting. I'm like, no way, I'm an NA. And so we went and they did a every A meeting, like outside this kind of like enclosed spiritual retreat. Would not fly. I can't imagine any circumstance. It was actually really cool. So the guy, it was a beautiful tent this guy had set up, and it very just really serene. Lights hanged up in this tent and rugs and seating. And he had like every fellowship's books. Like he had ones from, he had the AA books. He had all the NA books. Even like Journey Continues. He had Al-Anon book, an overeater's book. And then when people shared, and they did their preamble was based on whatever your addiction is how it said. So I thought it was really cool. The meetings were great. Most of them were NAers, which was cool, but it was really cool.
Yeah, that, you know, I've made that scene a little bit in the music world, like at the either the Wharf Rats or the, what do they call them with the string cheese incident? Again, there was they were the Jellyfish or something.
Oh, yeah.
But that, you know, where I normally have a strong preference for which A is my A.
Yeah.
But at a scene like that where everybody's together and there's everybody sort of trying to, but welcome and include everybody, and they're making accommodation for that. It is quite a cool and fun scene. You were mentioning in an earlier conversation about just sort of the experience of meeting people who are not addicts. Your encounter with humanity out there that was sort of the quote unquote normal world. What, you got anything on that?
Yeah. So I'm sure other recovering addicts feel this way. And it probably has a lot to do with me getting clean young too, because I was never social. I never had normal social skills. I mean, my interactions were using interactions, and they're based on, you know, what can you do for me and all that. So when I got to NA, and I was really scared of the real world, represented, and especially early recovery, were people that were using, you know? And so I always kind of felt like NA was it. And that was all right. There are great people in NA. But I just never, even when I had jobs in the real world, I didn't really go to the Christmas parties, or I didn't really hang out after work much. If I did, it was a very small interaction. And so I didn't really feel that comfortable socializing with normies, as I say. And this happened on that when I was 40, and then when I went to Thailand for 2 weeks, I was going to have this amazing spiritual quest, you know, and I'd be sitting in Buddhist temples, leg crossed, really getting in touch with my 11th step. And what really happened is, like, about 10 days into this thing, I realized I hadn't talked to like another human being. I was on this beach on this island with no meetings, hadn't talked to another, like, other than ordering a meal at a restaurant. And the internal dialogue was so loud and crazy, and I literally felt like I was going to go crazy if I didn't have like talk to somebody. So I saw these, two young ladies walking on a beach, and I, like, if they speak English, they're my best friends. So it took me like about a half day to muster up the nerve to talk to them. And I had been burning incense in my room to make the spiritual thing, and I had offered them one at the beach, and I thought that was the greatest thing ever. And apparently they were from Canada. They had been traveling with them, just themselves, for a while, and they were, I think, sick of talking to each other. So they were really happy for me to be talking to them, and for the next week we hung out all the time. And the first thing I was amazed is that normal people have similar problems, and their problems were they were having relationship issues back home, and they were millions of miles away, but in their head, they were stuck. They were living in issues that weren't there. And I remember, you know, I was first amazed, and I was, you know, sharing my experience of strength and hope and kind of that area. And we were all sharing. And one day, when we had been meeting every day at breakfast. And one day around breakfast, the one of the girls came to me. She said, "I wrote down that thing you told me in my journal." And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, what did I say?" And I'm like, "What did I say?" And she goes, "You said that thing about we strive for spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection." I'm like, "Oh my God, I just she's trying to sound good, you know?" And I'm like, "Oh my God, she's writing down things I'm saying." Like, I felt like, "Oh, I got to really be careful what I'm saying." And so I remember later that day, I was like, "You know, let me tell you a little bit about who I am." And I told her my story. I told her, you know, my, you know, getting clean and being clean, that I go to NA meeting, all that. And I said, but, and I told her, I said, "What's really interesting, I think we're like both on the spiritual journey, but I think the main difference is it seems like you're on this for some kind of form of enlightenment. And like, I'm on it so I don't commit felonies." And I don't know. And it was, but it was like when I really felt like when I could interact with normal people, that because they're not any more normal than we are, you know? And secondly, I felt like I could actually offer something to the conversation or to their lives, as well as offer something to my life. Like just having that interaction with these people, it changed my life. You know, I felt like I could interact with the real world I feel like, you know, at that point, and I had, you know, in my 20 years clean, but I truly felt I had I was an asset to my NA community, but I also felt I can be an asset to fellow travelers, you know, and I've carried a lot of that this year. So I don't have any problem. I've stayed at a lot of hostels and I've made some really good, I made really good friends, you know, and I have no problem telling people that when they want to know why I don't drink. It usually is how I feel at the moment, but I'll tell people flat out, you know, I think the last person asked me, I said, "Well, when I was 17, I went to rehab, and I've just never decided to start doing it again." You know, and I actually in India, I was people, because one thing when you travel through hostels in that backpack community, the main question is where are you from, where you've been, how long you've been here, what you've done here, and where you're going next, because you really want to find out where to go next where the people been. So when I got to that question, when I knew I was going to that convention, people were like, "Well, what's in that town?" Because it's not a tourist town. And I was kind of like hesitant to tell people. So I was just saying, I'm going to meet friends. And I've told like 8 or 9 people this who've asked me the same question. And just before someone had asked me that, this kid from the Netherlands was just telling me that, "Man, I got to stop," because I guess he found out I don't drink or something. And he goes, "I got to stop drinking so much because it's just really destroying my trip. It seems like that's all I'm doing. I'm not happy. I'm not really having fun." And just like right, like 10 minutes after he said that to me, someone asked me what I'm doing in that town. So I felt like I was obligated to say. So I said, "Well, I'm going into a 12-step convention." And like, and they're all like, "Well, what's that?" And of course, you know, standard answer is, "Well, you've heard of AA, right?"
Yeah.
And they hadn't, so I had to explain what a 12-step fellowship was. So I explained it to them, and most people were like, "Whatever." But the next day, I was hanging out with that kid, and we had gone swimming in this river and met some other people. And I said, "I need to," and he was giving me a ride, and he had rented a motor scooter, and he's giving me a ride. And I said, "I need to go to this travel agency to book a ticket because there wasn't Wi-Fi to do it on my phone." And he goes, "Yeah, I got to get a ticket out of here too." And I said, "Well, I'm going to take the train to the place you get, the closest airport." And he goes, "Yeah, I'll probably do that too." And I think from there, I'll probably fly to this town because that's where I'm going to get this convention. And he's looking at me like, "Do you want to come to the convention?" Because he kept looking at me like he was wanting to be invited to this convention. He goes, "Yeah, that's all right." And I'm like, "Yeah." I said, "It might be a little weird, you know, a lot of people hugging each other and stuff like that. You're not comfortable, you don't have to go, but or you can leave." And he goes, no, "I'll come." And he went to the convention with me. And he's never been to an NA meeting. His first meeting was at this Indian convention. And every once in a while, like, he hung with me a lot, but he did his own thing. And I would, every once in a while, look over to see if he was having fun or just by himself. And he would always be with a group of members of the fellowship there and seemed to be having a great time, you know. And he was,
You know, I've mentioned a couple of times on this podcast that one of my favorite lines from Living Clean is this line, something like, we think we have an extreme case of the human condition. And it's kind of what you're describing. You know, when once it's treated, it's just kind of a regular case of the human condition. But it turns out the 12 steps work really well for this thing called the human condition. And you know, I don't forget that I have this extreme case that can kick in if I'm not vigilant, if I don't take care of certain things. But when I do take care of those things, it doesn't serve me to see myself as so terribly different from my fellow human beings. They have a case of the human condition too.
Yeah. And even this weekend at this retreat, where most of the people I sat and talked to and had really great conversations with people are living the human condition, going through the same things we go through and having issues, wanting to live. You know, my thing is I'm living my dream. So I met a lot of people along this year that fellow travelers and have the wanderlust, and they want to know how to be able to do this and how to get their life in order, and you know, being able to share with them, you know, what I did and just, you know, how to live your passions, you know. And I've also asking a lot of people this year that I meet, like, what's their passion? You know, I like hearing people talk about their passions. And a lot of places I travel to is not the pictures of the place or the reading descriptions of it. It's how is when people say where they've been and how they say it, that breath of fresh air. Mm. And then London right now, I'm staying with some people that are not, you know, they're inviting me in their house and they're not NAers, you know, they're people that it's the mother of a girl that I met in India, you know, that invited me, and they invited me over to barbecues at their house and fun to hang out with.
Can you describe for me your spirituality, your approach to it, your experience of it, your belief about it, anything you want to say about it?
Sure. This might be controversial, but the 11th step kind of brought me to atheism, or my 11th step did. And my experience is I had absolutely no concept of God prior to coming to NA, none. And I realized very early in my recovery that if I was going to stay clean, have a chance of being able to, not even just stay clean, if I had any chance of being able to survive my life, the pain of being Greg, which is, looking back, they were very small problems, but it just was so overwhelming. That I needed most important, more than anything else in my life, I needed honesty, because I really didn't believe I had any capability of being honest. I really didn't feel I could be honest with myself. I could be honest with anybody else. And I felt like I needed compassion, love. I needed these qualities that I did not see, that didn't seem to be able to live in me. And that's what my higher power became. And I felt like when I communicated with that higher power, it was pure honesty. Like, that was the one place I couldn't lie to myself. I couldn't lie to anybody else. When I made a commitment to my higher power, it was a commitment I was going to follow through with. And it could be just get up and look for a job, stay clean for the day, go to a meeting, call my sponsor.
Well, let me just jump in there on that for a second, because it's so interesting to me that it's clear to me that the experience of the 12 steps is not about a belief. It's about an experience. It's about, you know, you just described something that has, you know, Martin Buber used to call it the I-thou quality, the relationship with the higher power that has some kind of an I-thou quality, which doesn't necessarily mean I think there's a God there necessarily, but the relationship has an I-thou quality. And that's, you just described that. You said,
Okay.
Yeah, didn't you? I mean, you said...
No, I agree. Yeah. I've never heard it. Anybody else kind of explain it that way too. So.
Yeah, and so the steps prescribe a certain experience. The seventh step prescribes an experience of making a humble appeal to this higher power.
Yeah.
It doesn't say, and you must believe this or that about this higher power. It just says the experience is one of making a humble appeal for some kind of freedom from these defects. And so Yeah, yeah. I find it actually quite fascinating and moving when someone who says, A, I'm an atheist, and B, I have an engaged, important relationship with a power greater than myself in the way that I believe and experience that. So,
yeah. And over the years, one thing I was always afraid to do was question my belief. Like, there's always like, don't analyze it. It's the only thing keeping you clean, buddy. And you can probably think this thing doesn't exist if you think about it too strongly. That was my fear. So my 11-step experience was this. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And I felt really strong entering my 11th step that I understood his will for me. And that was to be the best person I could possibly be for humanity and for myself. And that obviously starts with staying clean and being part of this program. And the power to carry that out, I really believed at that point, that power, those qualities I thought could never exist inside me truly existed inside of me. And I had the power to carry that out. I felt like it lived inside me. And I decided that there was nothing to pray for anymore. It was all there. And I also felt like I had always put this entitlement, maybe is the word, on the fact that since I had this understanding, this greater connection to a higher power than other people might, it gave me put me in a better situation. Like I was more worthy of things, maybe. And I think the 11th step made me feel like I was, you know, like, no, I'm not, you know, if I'm no better or different than anybody else, regardless of what they believe, what they think. And I thought the fact that I thought I was, the fact that I thought because I pray before I walk down a dark alley that I'm less likely to get jumped and mugged than the next person or more successful in my business. I just didn't feel that was right. I didn't feel that would be the higher power I wanted to subscribe to. I wanted to feel that, you know, I'm just equal to everybody else in the world. And that kind of made me feel, you know, kind of, and I was hesitant. I remember talking to my sponsor and I was like, I don't know if this is a good road I'm going down, you know? And he's like, you know, it's all about changing our beliefs as we, you know, as we grow along this program. And I just played with it for a little bit. And when I didn't find my recovery felt like it was unraveling and falling apart. And I also felt like if it is truly the higher power that I want, my higher power doesn't care if I believe in it. You know, my higher power doesn't need praising and altars. Well, and
let me ask you this, Greg, do you still pray? Do you meditate?
I set intentions and I do meditate. I meditate for silence and peace. And when I do achieve that, sometimes it's just a second where actually I'm not engaged in thoughts because I'm a big thinker and fantasizer, but when I do just sit quietly and breathe comfortably and just let my mind relax. And sometimes I'll achieve this, like just moments. Sometimes it's just a second of just pure peace where I'm not thinking and I'm just I'm living in a moment and I'm very present. And then I can recall. And it seems like when I do achieve that through that day, I just have a higher level of peace and I can feel like I can recapture that feeling. And I get a lot of that through doing yoga for myself. And I do set intentions and I offer people silent blessings. Something I got out of this retreat, actually out of the conscious speed dating. One of the exercises I did is look people in the eye and realize that they deserve the love that I want. And they're also capable of giving that love. And that's been my, like just today, as I was going through the subway system in London, I remember just on the subway thinking like everybody in this train is worthy of the love that I want and is capable of giving the love that I want. And that, you know, that it made me feel good. I don't think it did anything for them necessarily, but maybe just me being smiley and maybe might've creeped them out a little bit. I don't know. but that's what I do. So I set intentions and I don't pray for things anymore. You know, and I definitely don't pray for things for myself. You know, I wish things for people. I wish people to be healthy and happy. I kind of have a feeling like the universe is such a greater power than myself. And it does so many amazing things without me having any, you know, the earth is rotating in a in this direction. I don't even have a clue which direction it rotates, but it works. And for some reason, I'm not spinning off of it, you know? And if I just kind of go with that and not try to have it rotate a certain, my life seems to go much easier, you know? And so, and I think, and there's so many people in NA that have experiences in areas of life that with success, like in relationships or business, these are people with, that are power greater than myself, just as simply that they're not emotionally attached to my problems, you know? And so if praying, you know, if praying is talking to your higher power, that's me reaching out to people in NA. And if meditation is listening, that's me listening to what they're saying, you know, which, or even the whole meeting as a whole. So, and I think it's also, it gives you even a higher responsibility. It gives me a higher responsibility if I'm going to rely on the group as my higher power versus an entity or somebody I was just praying, something I was just praying to, is I have to be even more responsible to how I interact with my higher power, the group. I can't be messy in meetings. You know, I can't be getting resentments against my higher power, you know, and I have to try harder not to judge what people are saying. I think, well, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. I got to hear what the message is, you know, because I've decided that's what is going to make my higher power.
You know, I heard you use language like God's will, and which you seemed reasonably comfortable with, just, you know, like using that construct sort of as a metaphor for something. That's what has kind of emerged for me. I can use language that I wouldn't necessarily say aligns with what I believe literally, but I can use language as kind of like a metaphor for something experiential that is more universal and that doesn't require certain beliefs. I mean, my own head goes, how can I actually say what I know and believe about that which can't even be spoken of? And there's a great tradition within Judaism of, you know, speaking of God in ways that say God is the ineffable. And so anything we say about God after that must be metaphor. And so there's some kind of posture like that I can strike. And it just sounded to me like I heard you use language like God's will. And I heard what I thought I heard was the sort of the metaphor at work saying, what does that phrase mean to me, given my belief?
Yeah. Absolutely. And also, like, I always thought being an atheist, because I think it takes a lot of faith to be an atheist, that something doesn't exist. And when I think of atheists, I think of very fanatical, like, no, you're wrong, I'm right, there is nothing. And I don't feel that at all. And when I hear people share their experience with their higher power, I try not to judge it. I don't even like talking about it, because I know it's so important to so many people that I don't want to take that experience away, because it was important to me for so long. I don't think when someone shares their higher power that they're sharing something that doesn't exist, or they're mistaken or wrong. It's just not my experience that I'm having right now.
Yeah.
And I'm open to it. I'm open to anything, you know, and that's what I want to approach everything like. I want to be open-minded, but right now this seems to work, you know, and it seems to say I'm going to rely less on this thing that I'm having a hard time believing in, and more what I can believe in, which is the power of the fellowship, the group, the literature. And I think it's also really important to say, with 33 years clean, I have very little problems. I just don't, you know, and it does change. And I think sometimes we concentrate so much on the early recovery and all the stuff we go through and how what life can be a struggle. We allow the people that are sharing, dumping and sharing how miserable and what they're going through, because they need that. And we kind of sit back in the back, and I hear some people say, I hate meetings. It's just everybody with problems. And you don't want to go to meetings also. Sure. My life's perfect. I'm traveling the world for you. I have no problems, but that's what my life is today. There really aren't problems. I mean, there, things come up. I felt rejected by someone this weekend. And early in recovery, that would have had me. I the same situation happened in my first 2 years, and I had to write a full 4-step on that.
Let me ask you: was that at the conscious speed dating and felt rejected?
yeah, pretty much. It was. I mean, the conscious speed gets rejected by 20 people at one time. It was like in 1 hour.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, right. So I knew
kind of wholesale rejection.
Wholesale rejection, but I knew that going in. But it was just something really silly, and I was laughing as I was feeling the pain of it, the perceived pain of it. I was also laughing at myself and already looking for the spiritual solution, which was make as many people feel comfortable in their own skin as I can, you know? So I was being very friendly to people and greeting them and saying hello. But I remember early in recovery, a very similar situation went down at an NA convention where I felt rejected. And I had to literally ask a guy to be my sponsor because I didn't have a sponsor in that town at the time. Sit down and write a full length 4-step on that one moment and what it meant to my whole life. And get with him and share and all that, you know, and still, you know, have constantly pray and not, and where this, like, it was like, I was just laughing at myself that I still can get, you know, vulnerable and feel hurt for times and that I'm not immune to that, you know?
Yeah. And but I guess what I heard you saying there is that you still have that same experience of being a human being and feeling that rejection, but the context, the frame around it, the narrative that your life is enveloped in is so completely different now that you don't sink in, you know, you don't spin out over it. It's just, you can have the experience of being rejected and feeling those feelings.
Yeah. And I still went through the same process. Like, when I see them, I'm going to be mean to them, you know, and stuff like that. And then like, no, that's not who I am today. You know, and that doesn't solve anything, but you know, still I'm happy that my mind still goes there a little bit too, you know, and I don't deal with that very often. So it's great when it does happen, you know,
it sort of goes back to the theme of, when I got here, I had an extreme case of the human condition. And after I been here for a while and experienced some recovery, now I have a regular case of the human condition. So now I can be rejected and just be rejected without it meaning so much.
Yeah. Question you guys too, because I wonder this as much too, is how much of it, since we got clean young, stay clean for a long time, how much is it? I wonder what the percentage is recovery or just growing up and getting mature. I mean, obviously if it wasn't for recovery, we wouldn't be able to grow up and get mature, but I wonder, like, under different circumstances, how much of this stuff I would have just picked up anyhow in life.
Yeah. You know, I've actually thought about that a lot. That's been a theme that runs through my head, is that we attribute to recovery many of the characteristics and experiences that are really just about maturation. About aging. And but yeah, I think you touched right on it. You said we may not have been able to have those experiences of recovery and aging and maturing without recovery. So it is still attributable to recovery, even though it's allowing the human condition to be the human condition rather than this extreme case that makes me all sick and twisted.
The two things I get, I also get a lot of people like, 33 years, that must have been so hard. I'm like, no, that's the easiest thing I've ever done. I mean, at first it was hard, but now it's the easiest thing I do. And you tell me, what's the easiest thing you do all year long? Stay clean. I get to hang out with my friends, be great people, go eat. We go out and you go out to eat with people in recovery. If I would have somehow managed to use for 33 years, that would have been extremely difficult. I can't even imagine all the work and effort to have used for another 33 years.
Yeah.
And if I even was able to survive it. And the other thing is that kind of, and a lot of young people get this, is, oh, you're so lucky to get it so young. And it's like, oh, screw you. You know, like when we're like 13 and 14 years old, trying to scrape enough money, trying to find someone to actually sell to us and going through all that and having to deal with the conditions we were living in. And we look at people like, oh, what, with your degree, it must have been so hard at 30 to, you know, to keep yourself high, you know, and stuff like that. So it's like the opposite. I remember as a young person thinking, no, you guys had it easy. This was hard. And almost thought when they would say it, oh, I wish I got it when I was your age. Yeah. I figured almost being condescending. And I know from my circle of friends and people that, kids that went through rehab around the same time I did, some of them, a lot of them didn't stay clean. And some of those who didn't stay clean didn't survive. You know, one of my first amends on my first 8-step was to a parent of a kid that was one of my last using buddies, my age, actually just a couple of years, I think a couple of years younger, that went to the same rehab within months of the time I did, lives on the same street I did, all the same circumstances, went to the same meetings I went to. He relapsed and OD'd and died. And I did. I remember having to make amends to his family for things I did when, you know, for stealing beer out of the garage. But, you know, and just even then, just feeling how terrible that how the pain they must be going through, knowing that, you know, why their son didn't make it, and this kid down the street. And they were very gracious and happy for my recovery. But I mean, I remember that was the hardest amends to make, because I was so scared to just face them, not for my amends, but because I knew what pain they were going through, losing their son.
We think what we think is going to be supportive and nice to say to a young person, like, I wish I would have gotten clean as young. It must be so great to get clean as young as you. And it sort of makes them feel like they're, it's not helpful. Much better thing to say to a young person is, you want to be the auctioneer?
No. Exactly. That's exactly. Just treat it like, you know, hey, I'm glad you're here. Just like you treat any other newcomer, you know? When I went to the convention in Brazil, in Rio, I went to this meeting in São Paulo, and I got to the meeting a little bit late. Nobody was there to translate for me. It's a rough neighborhood. I was tired. I wasn't really enjoying the meeting because I couldn't understand a word. And this thing about, oh, you can feel what people are saying. Maybe you can. I can't. So I was not having much fun. There's this kid sitting next to me at the meeting. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the meeting, this dog came wandering in the meeting, and it stunk so bad. It was just this rough street dog. And he just sat down in the middle of the meeting. And I thought it was hilarious. The kid thought it was kind of hilarious. So I just got out my phone, turned on my data, which I have very little data, but I was going to make some fun of this. So I was translating, using Google Translate to say things to this kid. And I was telling him that dog needs to call his sponsor. And the kid was just dying. But we were trying not to, we were almost disrupting the meeting because we were trying to laugh so hard. And so after the meeting, someone actually came up and could translate. And so we're talking to them. And the kid asked to the translator, he wants to know how long I've been clean. So I tell him, and I think it was last year, so I had 32 years clean at the time. And then, you know, I look young for my age. So people, like, when I say that, they like, well, how old were you and got clean? That's usually the second question. And I said 17. And I saw this look in this kid's face. Just, you can tell it's like it was an internal something, a light switch went on. Like, he really just lit up. It was like, and like, so I was really curious what he was saying back to him. And what he said, he goes, I'm 17. So if I stay clean, I'll someday have 33 years clean like you. And it was just like, it became the best meeting I hit in all of Brazil. And I didn't understand a word anybody was saying, but because of the translator, because I mean, I really saw the hope come alive in this kid, you know? And I'm sure, you know, he was attracted to the fact that not only did I have 30, but I was able to sit in a meeting and make fun of this stinking dog and taking it all kind of light. But, you know, I was here, had a lot of clean time.
That's great. I think you gave me my fade to the music ending there, I think.